dangerous would whistle like that," Hester said, clearly moved by the sound. They waited, then bent to the task of weeding the heavy pumpkin vines. Soon the green growth would die, leaving the orange pumpkins to ripen in the late autumn sun, one of the last crops to be sold at market before it closed for the season. A few late beets, some lima beans and potatoes, and the days at market would be over. They worked in solitude, their argument forgotten, each one bent to her own task and her own thoughts. New life flowed in Hester's veins, filling her with a renewed sense of purpose. She had found her place on Earth. She embraced the reason Kate had found her, the reason she'd left the farm, even the fact that Billy had found her and brought her to Emma Ferry, who had ushered her into the path of the town's needy, the penniless, the weak. She knew how they felt, the feeling of being an outcast. Hadn't she felt that way all her life? No more. Her soul sang within her. Over and over, the waves of a new understanding lapped at the edges of her own lack of self-worth, wearing it away, creating a sense of peace, of purpose. Everything, her marriage to William, his death, her senseless servitude and lack of trust in herself and her husband, had prepared her for this venture. Freed from self-blame, she began to whistle, to hum, to break into song as tears dripped off the end of her nose. She froze when a figure stood directly in front of her. Straightening slowly, she found a tall Indian. His black hair parted in the middle, a heavy braid down his back, his skin darker than her own. His nose was prominent, his eyes quick and black and restless. His clothes were the same brown, made of skins, as any white frontiersman. A knife was thrust through the wide leather belt, and he carried a rifle and a gunpowder horn slung over his shoulder. "Hello," he addressed Hester in perfect English. She met the eyes that were blacker than her own and recognized a part of his face. This was the Indian youth who had moved through the trees like a wraith. She had seen him, heard his whistle. Cold chills crept up her back. The blood drained from her face, leaving her dizzy, lightheaded. "Who are you?" she whispered.
"I am of the tribe of Lenape. I believe I know who you are. I have watched you for many years. Only now do I make myself known. Your mother was of my tribe. We played together as children. I have come to ask you to go with me to the Ohio River where my people dwell on its banks. I will give you time. I am on my way to the great waters and will return in the spring when winter has gone."
Hester could not stand alone. She sank to the ground, slowly folding under this unexpected arrival from her past. Instantly, the Indian brave was beside her, extending his hand to help her to her feet. She shook her head, keeping her eyes lowered to the restless hands in her lap.
"I do not want to disturb you. You have the winter to decide if you will accompany me. You will consent someday to be my wife. I have hoped for many years."
Hester lifted her face to meet his eyes. They were black, but kind, gentle, and alive with interest in her alone. A magnetic force rose from his eyes, and she stood, unaware that she had risen to her feet. The meeting of their eyes could not be broken. With so much they recognized in each other, he placed his hand on her arm, taking her trembling hand in his own. She was close enough to see the texture of his skin, the strong cords of his neck. He smelled of animal skins, dust, gunpowder, and sweat. His hair glistened with grease in the ways of her people.
"Thank you for allowing me the winter to decide," she whispered,
after long moments had elapsed.
"That makes me very happy,"
the Indian said. Then,
"My name is Hunting Wolf."
"I am Hester King. I was Hester Tsuk before marrying."
He nodded.
"Your husband died?"
"Yes."
"Your mother's name was Corn Maiden."
Hester gave only a weak wave of her hand, a dipping of her dark head to acknowledge what he said. She was thankful for his words, but confusion veiled her ability to understand why he had waited all this time, why he had suddenly made himself known.
"You are Lenape."
"Yes."
Hester smiled then, directly meeting his eyes.
His face softened, his eyes became black velvet, the longing true, forthright, and honest.
I will return. Think on my words, dearest one. I will take you to my lodge so you can meet your cousins, your brothers, but not without your consent.
Thank you. Without another word, he turned and disappeared, blending into the waving grasses and the thick line of trees, as if to hide the sight of her confusion. Buppy lifted her freckled face to the bright sky and gave a low whistle.
Hoo-wee!
That was all she said, before turning to face Hester with a look that was undecipherable in her brown eyes. Finally, she placed a hand on Hester's back, gave a small pat, and said,
Isn't life crazy, my friend? Just when you thought you had it all figured out, along comes a new direction, huh?
She gave Hester another small pat.
Remember, all your troubles come from men.
Bewildered, Hester turned her face to Buppy, a frightened look widening her eyes.
Are you sure?
Chapter 20. The curb market of late summer was a spectacular sight. Every member of the township, and those who lived inside the town and did not have room for a garden, hurried to the market to purchase the last of the produce to store down cellar. Farm wagons rattled by, men urging their horses to a fast trot, their straw hats clamped low on their brows, bringing in the potatoes and squash and apples. The smell of cider hung in the air as the steam-driven press clapped and sputtered while juice ran from a pipe into wooden buckets. Carriages that shone like glass, drawn by high-stepping horses, their necks arched like proud swans, their manes and tails braided with red ribbon, moved slowly through the crowd, enjoying the attention they received. Amish farmers sold potatoes and turnips, pumpkins and squash, but no one's vegetables were arranged quite like Buppy's. The largest crowd always surrounded her colorfully displayed goods. Hester wore a light black coat, just enough to fend off the stiff breeze. She moved as if in a dream, her thoughts certainly not on her duties, as she arranged the heavy orange pumpkins, counted the yellow squash, and shooed away a few bees that kept droning around the beet tops. She stopped working when the hulk of a man named Reuben Troyer threw a look in Buppy's direction as she hawked the merits of her fine vegetables as usual.
Someone should tell her to go home to the kitchen where she belongs. No woman should be allowed to sell things in that manner.
Hester smiled. Oh, she's very good at selling vegetables. She looked at him directly, humor flashing from her dark eyes. His mouth slid up into a wobbly smile, his eyes becoming soft as they caught Hester's goodwill.
Ah, yes, so she is, yes, yes.
He moved on, graced by the most beautiful smile he had ever encountered. He told his wife that Hester was like an angel, so beautiful was she. Luckily, the large, big-boned Rachel agreed with him, and he whistled the whole way to the barn to do his chores. Hester mollified any displeased customers with pleasant words and a frequent smile. When her teeth flashed white in her dark face, two dimples appeared in her cheeks. Her eyes laughed pleasantly as she spoke, universally warming everyone who saw her. She stored the beet tops in a crate out of Buppy's sight. At the end of the day, she told Buppy she was going to the poor section of town to take some of the day's leftovers. She didn't say what she was taking, just leftovers. Buppy was exhausted and drained after her long day's work, hunched over her money bag, counting coins, so she waved a hand, and Hester went on her way, triumphant. For once, she did not need to make a decision. For once, she could pursue the passion she had so often dreamed of. She carried the crate on one hip, balancing it with an arm flung over top. She walked fast, her long strides taking her down Market Street, then left onto Vine, where the street became more narrow. A row of squalid houses sat at the bottom of the incline, like blobs of mud someone had thrown. Strangely, there were no children racing around in the mud. No youth lounging in doorways. An eerie quiet pervaded the street. Hesitant now, Hester set the crate beside the first house, where the door swung crookedly on leather hinges,
its wood darker and smoother from so many grimy hands pulling it shut and pushing it open. Placing her fist on the door, she rapped loudly. Immediately, a white face appeared beside her, a mop of tangled brown hair above it, the mouth covered in dirt, the neckline of her dress torn, exposing painfully thin shoulders. The small child glared, her eyes as alert as a chipmunk.
"Hello, may I come in?" Hester asked.
Like a flash, she disappeared. Hester waited. Another white face appeared, almost level with her own, blotched and with swollen cheeks protruding below sunken dark eyes. The woman wore a dark dress. Matted hair clung to her head, and a thin baby rode on her hip, sucking on a questionable item.
"What? What you want?"
Hester smiled, which brought a black look of suspicion from the woman.
"I have some greens here from the vegetable cellar at market. I thought you might want to cook them for your supper. They don't cost anything."
"We don't eat that stuff."
"Oh, it's good. Cooked with salt, a bit of vinegar."
"Couldn't eat it."
Hester sighed. How could she begin if they wouldn't accept her offer? From inside the house, the sound of crying rose to a crescendo until Hester thought she must break down the door to find the cause. "Is something wrong?"
"Oh, my boy stepped on a rusty nail and his foot swole up so bad I don't know what to do with it."
"If you'll allow me, I'll take a look at it."
Reluctantly and offering no other welcome, the woman stepped aside, leaving only a narrow passage for Hester's entrance. The smell was the worst. Always from her first step into these dwellings, the odor of grime, spoiled food, unwashed bodies, and earthen floors was the hardest. Breathing as lightly as possible, her head bent, Hester entered the dark room. On a wooden pallet in a corner, she found the source of the agonized wailing. A small boy clutched both hands around a grotesquely swollen foot, angry red streaks reaching almost to his knees, his mouth open in wails of pain and anger. Hester fell to her knees beside him. She gripped the foot and uncurled the filthy little hands as his wails turned to terrified screams.
Don't, here, don't cry. I just want to see if I can help you. I won't hurt you. Shh."
The small boy lay back, attaching his gaze unwaveringly on Hester's face.
"I need a light," she said crisply.
"Don't have one."
"Yes, you do. Get it."
Hester was angry now. She knew they had some source of light, even if it was only the stub of a candle. Suddenly, a sputtering candle was placed in front of her. She held it to the foot. Instantly, the screaming started anew. She had seen everything she needed to know. An angry, festering wound with pus pushing against it, desperately needing to be lanced, drained, and then treated with a fresh poultice of scabious. She could see the plant, its heavy, soft, whitish-green leaves, their edges ragged, the clumps of pale blue flowers. It grew in meadows and old fields left untilled. She knew where a fine clump of it grew close to the road, leading out to Buppy's patch of vegetables. She rose, her eyes seeking the mother's face.
"I will return tomorrow if you will allow me. The wound needs to be opened and crushed leaves of the scabious plant applied to draw out the infection."
"You aren't no doctor."
"No, but I know about healing with herbs."
"If you come, make sure it's not when my husband is home."
"Please don't tell him if he will become angry."
No.
Agreeable now, the woman's eyes sought Hester's face.
"Will my John die?"
Hester looked at the sniffling child, his flushed face, and wondered if another day would mean his condition would deteriorate to the point of no return.
"No," she said.
The woman nodded stoically, as if any emotion would be her undoing. Life was what it was, and she could do nothing to alter it. To stay alive, to keep her children alive, took all the energy she could muster. Hester looked around the dim room. Two small windows let in a minimum of light. The small fireplace was black with smoke, soot, and damp air. Cold ashes were piled in a wet-looking heap. Bits of string, twigs, and pieces of stone lay scattered across the floor, A table, small but sturdy enough, with benches pulled up on each side. A few more pallets covered with colorless blankets. A cupboard, several wash tubs hanging on nails, and odd crates containing what Hester guessed were towels or rags or extra clothing, furnished the room. Where was the food kept? Was there food? She sat down quickly when the door was flung open and a large, dust-covered man entered the room. His heavy eyebrows were drawn down over his eyes, which were only slits in his face. A bulbous red nose stood above a mouth that held a constant snarl. He walked over to Hester and told her to leave now in a voice that was both grating and wheezing.
Heinz, no. The lady wants to help our John.
The voice of his wife seemed to hold surprising authority. He looked at her, and only for a moment, Hester saw the glint of acknowledgement.
How is he?
Not good.
Hester spoke. If he does not get help, he will die of the infection. Do you see these red streaks? Going to the child, she lifted the leg, pointing to the angry red marks. That can turn into poison of the blood. If he turns feverish overnight, he will die. The big, burly German named Heinz turned his eyes on her, mere slits of blue, flashing now.
Get out. If we need a doctor, we will fetch one. Get!
He raised an arm, his long, thick finger pointing in the direction of the door. The ragged edges of his filthy sleeve shook with the force of his anger. Hester looked at the threatening hulk of a man, then down to the boy, who had curled up into a fetal position, whimpering like a hungry puppy. The sound brought an explosion of unnamed emotion in Hester. She faced Heinz squarely and told him in a level voice ringing with authority that she would be back and there was nothing he could do about it. His son would die if he did not allow her to help. They had nothing to pay a doctor. She had heard Emma's tales of the town's doctors treating the less fortunate without pay, perhaps a sack of potatoes or a chicken at best. But after years of going into the squalid conditions of these streets, they would no longer venture there. In turn, all sorts of strange practices, old wives' tales, myths, mysterious chantings and wailings could now be heard among the sick in this part of town. Heinz's shaking finger stayed. He shifted his gaze to her face. Slowly, he lowered his arm and turned away. The boy on the pallet moaned. Hester left the red beet tops and the bits of potato, as if she'd forgotten them. She lost no time hurrying home, looking neither left nor right, her long steps taking her to the stable in the backyard. Buppy called out the back door. Hester waved, but quickly disappeared into the small stable. She yanked a surprised Silver from his stall and, without bothering to brush his matted coat, flung the harness on his back, adjusted the buckles, put the bridle on his head, and backed him between the shafts of the serviceable black buggy. She was unwinding the reins when the back door clunked shut, and Buppy strode across the yard.
Hester, stop! Where are you going?
To the meadow to get scabious.
Can I come too?
Suit yourself. Buppy attached the britching and traces to the shafts on her side, then climbed to the buggy. She sat forward tensely as if Hester's driving made her nervous. As it should have, the way Hester guided poor Silver. She was requiring the utmost speed from the dependable animal, who was never given to fast trots, only a contented clopping along, a regular old farm workhorse.
What do you need?
Buppy asked finally.
Scabious. What is that?
A plant.
Why?
A boy will die if I don't have the chance to treat his infected foot.
Just one plant?
No, if I can find nettles, I'll use them too.
Nettles are all over the place.
Good. Hester watched the fast-sinking sun. She shivered in the cool evening breeze. She hoped the scabious plant would be where she thought she remembered seeing it. Buppy's lips were grim. For Hester, the knowledge of herbs and their uses was a direct golden thread to her past, a redemption, proof that her history was retrievable, worthy. She was not only the illegitimate daughter of an outcast young Indian maiden. She was shamed many times afterward, abused by her stepmother, lowered by her husband and mother-in-law, lowered until she had no idea who she was. More than ever, the passion to pursue the dream of healing rose within her. Hester turned her face to Buppy.
I want to do this. I know it works. You would too if you had met the ancient old grandmother, her face like wrinkled leather, her eyes containing an inward light, so brilliant was she. She knew every plant, every tree. She could name all the barks of the trees, all the mosses, all the mushrooms. Every plant has been put on God's earth because of its vital use to us. An important part of life is vanishing as Indians flee Lancaster County. You don't have to agree, Buppy. Just give me a chance to honor my ancestors. It's all I can do.
Buppy was shocked to see Hester's chin wobble, then observe a quick dash of her hand across her eyes, as if when the emotion came, it was unwelcome. Buppy looked straight ahead, blinked and swallowed, then cast a sidelong look at Hester, lifted her nose, and sniffed. She blinked furiously before she said,
If you let me, I'll help what I can. Not that I know very much.
Whoa! Hester drew back on the reins. Silver lifted his head to release the pressure of the bit on his mouth, lowered his backside, and slid to a stop.
There it is, Hester breathed, handing over the reins. In a flash, she was off the buggy and across the overgrown grasses.
Her foot caught on the undergrowth, and she fell headlong, fell flat into the waving grasses as clumsy as an ox. Buppy lifted her face and howled with glee. Hester didn't look back, just waved a hand above her head, got up, and kept going. Her face was alive with energy, an inner light radiating from her dark eyes as she held up a clutch of strange-looking mint-green plants with red roots, a passel of limp, pale blue flowers on top.
Perfect. I thought you needed nettles.
I have some.
They drove back wordlessly. Silver lifted his head and trotted briskly, as if he got the message and meant to do them proud. Walter Trout was watching across the backyard fence like a great nosy dog, his liquid eyes filled with love and trust, his face shining pink in the glow of the setting sun. His great slabs of arms lay across the top of the fence, his fingers entwined like sausages below his face. Buppy and Hester both knew he was a cauldron of unsatisfied curiosity. They winked at each other, smiled, and ducked their heads. Silver, loosened from the shafts, walked obediently away, the sweat staining his silver hair to a dull gray. He lowered his head to drink thirstily from the long cast-iron trough that rested on a stone base.
"Hello, ladies!" Shrill and energetic, Walter voiced his presence.
Good evening, Walter.
Nice evening now, isn't it?
Indeed.
Silver lifted his head, water dribbling from his mouth. He smacked his lips, making the funny sound horses do when they have almost drunk their fill, usually returning their mouths to the water for a few more swallows.
Too nice for you ladies to stay home, then?
Oh, yes.
Hester led Silver through the barn door and into a small box stall as Buppy turned to close the door to the harness cupboard.
Market went well, I gather?
Yes, we had a good day.
That's good.
Hester reappeared.
You're off in a bit of a hurry, I saw.
A bit.
You got what you were after?
Oh, yes.
Without further words, Hester and Buppy headed for the back door, leaving the herbs in the safety of the buggy.
You'll be over later?
Poor Walter was slowly accepting that he could not extract a sliver of knowledge about where they had been or why.
Maybe.
With a wave over her shoulder, Buppy opened the back door and held it, allowing Hester to go before her. They laughed freely, deliciously, knowing they would relieve poor Walter's insatiable curiosity later. Their presence in the Trout home was lauded with many grand bows of welcome. Walter all but ran back and forth, bringing them cups of tea and fresh slices of custard pie sprinkled heavily with nutmeg. He brought a plate of cheese, yellow and pungent, a bowl of popcorn salted and buttered lavishly. The two boys, their faces freshly washed and wearing thin, homemade nightclothes, sat up to the table, their eyes bright and alert. The oldest one nodded and shook his head now, Emma informed the women proudly. He did not speak, but at least he was communicating something. Clearly, Emma was in her element. Her eyes snapped with sparks of energy. Her face was as pink as Walter's. She bent to the boys, crooning, placing the palm of her hand on their cheeks, brushing back locks of hair that had never been out of place. She cut their custard pie in small pieces. Walter placed a tin cup of buttermilk at each plate, then watched joyously as each child lifted it carefully and drank thirstily. They talked of market, about going to church on Sunday. They spoke of William's passing, the time that had already elapsed. Walter hovered, refilled teacups, inquired whether one small slice of custard pie was enough. Yet his English manners would not allow him to ask them where they had gone earlier. Emma spoke around a mouthful of custard pie, which Hester could see made Walter cringe to the point of carefully wiping his own mouth daintily.
"We have named the boys now. We called them One and Two for so long until we decided a pet would be named long before these dear ones."
Proudly, Walter said their names were Sebastian and Vernon. Sebastian began to cry, a weak, mewling sound at first, which rose to sobbing and hiccuping, sending Emma to his side in great distress.
"What? What?"
She kept repeating the word, seeming to try to relieve her own guilt, yet taking the blame for his crying entirely on herself. His voice was only a croak, an unoiled piece of machinery, but they heard his words clearly in spite of it.
"My name is Richard."
Emma's face turned a shade darker, and her small eyes seemed to grow from the folds of her cheeks. She clapped a hand to her rounded bosom, where the row of tiny pearl buttons creased the gray fabric, and said softly,
"Mein Gott, das Kind sprechen!"
Walter put a heavy arm about his shoulders, smiled into his face, and praised him effusively. Richard looked up into Walter's reddening face, the beginning of a smile forming at the edge of his mouth. Hester got up. "I must go. I have a few herbs to prepare for the morning." Walter looked at her, his curiosity buzzing.
"Where are you off to?"
"Home." She went around to Richard and hugged him. "Welcome to our family, Richard. We're so glad you are with us." She kissed the small cheek, which brought a definite widening of his mouth.
"Good thing. Good thing."
Buppy meant Richard's speech, Hester knew, and accepted her lack of social skill, her inability to convey feelings. Then Hester nodded to Walter, thanked him for the tea, finally telling him about the herbs in the meadow and that she'd be making poultices, tinctures, and a liquid medicine as well. "I have a sick little boy to tend to in the morning." Walter was grateful for that bit of information. He sat down heavily and cut a large wedge of pie, thanking his stars that Emma was a talkative woman and gave forth her information readily, unlike these strange Amish. Back in their own kitchen, Hester stoked the fire while Buppy retrieved the herbs. They boiled the roots, chopped the scabious plant, and bottled some of it in the strong corn whiskey Hester kept for this purpose. They boiled the nettle roots separately and bottled them, too. Darkness had fallen by the time they were finished. Hester paced the kitchen, straightened doilies, and fiddled with the candle wax. Finally, she told Buppy she would never be able to sleep. Buppy became quite huffy, saying if she was even thinking of going down to that dirty place in the dark, she was going alone. Hester said she would then. "I have to see him tonight. He may be seriously feverish till morning."
"You are risking your life. It's too foolish. You can't go down there."
Hester nodded. That was all. Already she was putting on her black shawl and hat and pulling on a thin pair of gloves, her jaw set in a line of determination. Buppy watched her, staying silent as Hester gathered the jars, herbs, and a small knife, some white muslin, and a scissors, then put them carefully into a cloth satchel and let herself out into the dark street. Buppy called after her,
"If you're not back by 10 o'clock, I'll come looking for you."
Hester waved, her long strides separating her from Buppy's voice. At midnight, she had not returned. Buppy lay cowering in her feather bed, alternately praying and being angry at Hester and her foolishness. Hadn't she warned her? She tried to summon the courage to get dressed and go find her, but could not bring herself to do it. Better one person dead than both of them. At this thought, her heart began banging beneath her ribs until she thought she would surely be torn apart, rib by rib. When the gray light of dawn finally lightened the dark windows, she got up, tired, miserable, and vowing to herself that she would not go down to those stinking row houses. She didn't care if Hester was dead or alive. As she combed her flaming red hair and scrubbed her freckled face, she considered going to the town constable to tell him about Hester. But as she ate her steaming bowl of cornmeal mush, she figured it would be better to go see for herself what had happened to Hester. She would wear her high-topped boots this time and carry a large walking stick, just in case. Chapter 21. Hester stayed all night in the pitiful hovel after lancing the wound, draining the thick, greenish infection, and applying the poultice. She spooned up a decoction of the bark of the white oak and the bud of the acorn from the same tree and heated the mixture to a soothing warmth. The child resisted at first, then willingly drained the liquid from the spoon. Heinz lay rolled in a blanket on a pallet in the corner, his rasping snores settling themselves inside Hester's head until she thought she could no longer keep her sanity intact. Least he was not interfering, snoring like that, she told herself, as the weary night ticked toward morning. At the first gray light of dawn, she lifted the cover from the sleeping boy and turned his foot toward the flickering candle she held to it. She lowered her head and sniffed the wound. The absence of the sickish sweet smell, a revelation, she lifted her face, closed her eyes, and whispered a direct, "Denke, mein Herr." When Heinz rolled out of his pallet onto the earthen floor like a great animal, Hester stiffened and kept her face averted. He rose to his knees, then to his feet, and began scratching his armpits and his filthy hair. He thrust his feet into the shabby, torn shoes made of leather, belched, coughed, and let himself out the door without a word to his wife or acknowledging Hester's presence. His wife's name was Josephine, but her pronunciation of it was funny. She told Hester to call her Finny. She could not speak English well, her German permeating every word, so that they each had a flat sound mingled with all the wrong consonants. She was sincere, though, and she cared about her boy, John. Heinz worked at the tannery on Water Street, Finny informed Hester, which explained the loathsome odor that followed him like a cloud. The dead animals and their hides piled in stinking heaps to dry and then be made into leather were odorous. There seemed to be nothing to do about it. It was a thriving business in the town of Lancaster, a necessary evil, if anything. Some horses hitched to carriages refused to travel past the tannery, balking and rearing. Others lowered their heads, took the bits in their mouths, and ran at breakneck speed, the buggies swaying and clattering over the stones, the drivers' hats crushed low on their heads, their hands occupied solely by handling the reins. More than one schoolboy took to loitering about the tannery, gleefully swooping in on an airborne hat and racing off with it before the harried owner could return to retrieve it. When the first rays of the sun enlivened the street outside, Hester swept the floor and helped Finny stoke the fire. She boiled water, poured some in a wooden bucket, added cold from the crock by the back wall, and asked for soap. Finny shook her head, spreading her hands, palms up. Hester nodded and set to work with one of the muslin patches in her bag. She scrubbed the table first, then the benches. She swept and scoured the meager hearth, while Finny brought out a loaf of coarse brown bread, bought from the fat baker on Queen Street. Hester's eyes narrowed. For 2 pennies, Finny could buy a sack of meal, a bit of lard, and some salt. She could make her own bread. There was no milk, no eggs, no porridge, or butter. only the coarse brown bread torn into chunks. The children sat to the table in the same clothes they slept in, reaching for their share of the bread and stuffing it hungrily into their mouths. Their eyes were wizened far beyond their years, their thin faces colorless and translucent.
"Where is Heinz? Does he not want his breakfast?"
Finny made a sound not unlike an irate horse.
"Nothing to eat?"
"Of course. He eats good down there. But a man has to have his food."
Hester shook her head, brought in the beet tops, washed them with the small amount of potatoes, and put everything in a pot.
"Salt?"
Finny shook her head. When Buppy's anxious face appeared at the door, Hester did not waste any words explaining her night. She sent her straight back to the house with a list of items they would need. Buppy muttered and complained, disgruntled, but did as she was told, returning with a wagon load of supplies. And they went to work. They scoured the house with strong lye soap. They washed the thin blankets and tubs of boiling water out in front of the house, by the street, where all the neighbors came to watch, their eyes hooded with suspicion and mistrust. Children threw sticks and called them names. Buppy lifted her hands from the hot, soapy water and ran after one especially bold child, caught him by the suspenders, and tweaked his ear. That brought a loud, surprised squawk and a scattering of the rest of the bystanders. Hester grinned and kept scrubbing the filthy blanket up and down on the washboard. Leave it to Buppy. They nailed the scrubbed wooden crate to the wall, then filled it with meal, a tin of lard, a bag of salt, flour ground from fresh wheat kernels, a jar of tomato preserves, and a bag of potatoes. They brought towels and sheets and two extra quilts. They brought crockery dishes and pewter spoons. Emma and Walter cried, wiped their tears, and contributed soap, dried corn, bread, and a hunk of bacon. Buppy said she was one solid mess of chills, climbing up her back and down her arms. Her nose burned all day, and all she wanted to do was cry. It was the spirit quickening her, she said. Embarrassed, then, she lowered her head and asked Hester what in the world was she thinking washing these blankets if they had nowhere to dry. She said it gruffly, as if that would prove that she was not turning into a soft-hearted person. Hester remedied the clothesline situation by having Walter string a heavy rope from his and Emma's house to Buppy's, a sturdy line that would hold many clothes for years to come. Finny held her sickly baby, fed him, then sat on the lone, rickety chair and stared into space. She did not offer to help or hinder them. She allowed them to clean and wash, her eyes veiled with an expression of mystery. When Walter contributed the armless rocking chair, they told Finny to sit in it. She sank onto the seat obediently and began to rock, stiffly at first. Then, at a slow, steady, relaxed rhythm, she lowered her head as the tears began to fall, dripping steadily, until her arms and hands glistened in the firelight where they gathered. Little Chon ate his bread. Hester brought him a tin cup of buttermilk and a bowl of salted vegetables. He looked at Hester's face, his large eyes asking her if it was all right to eat it. She nodded, so he bent his head, lifted the spoon, and ate every bit, greedily licking the bowl to get every last bit of salt. His recovery was imminent now. Pink highlights appeared in his face, and he smiled and talked to his younger sisters. Hester kept the plaster of the scabious plant tied firmly in place, and he had to remain on the pallet. Hester and Buppy asked Finny's permission to bathe the children, wash their hair, and then dress them in the clothes Emma had given to the family while they washed the ones they were wearing. Tearfully, she nodded. First, they doused their heads in strong-smelling coal oil with peppermint added to the lye soap to rid the children of lice. They did not cry out, sturdily bearing the hot water and strong fumes, squeezing their eyes shut as they allowed Buppy's furious scrubbing. The day was waning into evening when the two women stopped. Enough had been done. Finny said she knew how to make bread, but she had no lard and no money to buy it. Patiently, they explained about the butcher's back door and the vats of rendered lard available for taking,
She could bring home a large tin of it that would last for months, for one penny. Finny shook her head, overcome. The goodwill that radiated from the clean hovel was infectious, and Buppy and Hester were radiant, fulfilled. They walked home in the golden glow of early autumn, pulling the emptied wagon, chattering together like magpies dressed in dark Amish colors, their muslin capstrings lifting and falling with the rhythm of their steps. Buppy was duly impressed. She'd never seen anything work like that crazy plant, that weed that grew all over the place. You'd think the child would die drinking that stuff in the bottle. What was it? Purple wine? She fussed and waved her arms, quite forgetting to help pull the cumbersome wagon up the hill to Mulberry Street, until Hester stopped for breath, leaned against a lamppost, and exhaled. Buppy never took notice. She merely stopped with Hester, lifted her hands, and asked how in the world she knew this stuff. And what else grew all over the woodlands and meadows that she knew had the ability to heal? Hester laughed, told her she'd see, and went straight to Walter and Emma's house. Little Richard opened the door, peering around it like a shy deer mouse, and every bit as cute.
"Do come in," he said,
for all the world like a little butler. "Thank you, Richard," Hester said, smiling, then scooped him up and planted a kiss on his cheek. She was rewarded by a clenching of his arms around her neck like a vice. With so much happiness and so great a purpose in her life, Hester spoke with energy and enthusiasm, completely forgetting her steaming cup of tea. It turned cold as she related her rewarding day of giving to the poor and helping Finny to climb out of the pit of despair where she had no longer cared whether she lived or died. So great was the burden of staying alive. Emma lifted a finger.
"Hester, I don't mean to lower your banners, but don't be surprised if Finny returns to her old ways. Remember, you two women did all the work. She may not want to continue."
As it was, Heinz proved to be the biggest obstacle. He swore, tore down the wooden crate, and said no two Amish do-gooders were ever going to tell him what he could do and what he couldn't, and they were not going to tell him how to raise his family either. But Finny remained steadfast and calm, going about her days with renewed purpose. Seeing little Chon on his feet, alive and healthy, his eyes shining, was enough inspiration for her to continue to cook the limp vegetables, make her own bread, and buy lard and salt. Regularly, Hester or Buppy, sometimes both, would visit, encouraging, praising, and bringing her a squash, a pumpkin, some turnips or potatoes. One week before the market would be closing because the vegetables were finished, Heinz left the tavern in a drunken rage and smashed all the tannery windows with a club. He was caught, fined, which of course he could not pay, and was thrown into the worst cell in the dank, rat-infested cellar of the town's jail. Finny was quite unperturbed.
"He will dwiggle up, dry up, funked now," she said firmly, pounding and kneading the bread dough as if it was Heinz himself being punished roundly for all his drinking.
She stopped, then gave the bread dough one last pat. Like a wise owl, her eyes large and round, she said bitterly,
"My Heinz was not always so. It is the ale. He can't let it alone."
Her words were so infused with the German, her O's a total other sound. Alone became alone, the is a sharp is. But the strength of her words was enough to let the women know she loved Heinz still. But he needed to get better, and jail was a godsend. Hester held the baby, her eyes dark and alive with interest, listening as Finny talked. Finny was strong, an amazing woman, keeping her children from starving in the rawest conditions. When the winds of autumn became chilly, the leaves of the trees blew through the town and filled the gutters. Rains pounded them into a slimy brown soup that lay in every ditch. Finny needed firewood. She burned every stick she could find, her pride keeping this problem from Hester until she was forced to speak to her. The children were coming down with the chilblains, rashes, and angry blisters on their lips. Soberly, the women rode to church,
silver running along sedately, as if he knew this was the Lord's day. In their black shawls and bonnets, they rocked together comfortably in the roofless buggy, the road wet and puddled, brown streaks of water spitting from the wheels as they traveled. They did not speak, for Hester's thoughts were muddied and clouded over with the knowledge of winter coming and the decision she would soon have to make. She thought of the handsome brave named Hunting Wolf and his true, honest love for her. She believed he came from the Lenape, as he had said. He was not someone who repulsed her. A part of her longed to see her mother, her cousins and sisters, perhaps brothers. But that was all. Having been married before, she knew the tremendous effort it would take, the constant work, the drawing on every reserve of love and affection just to make it through her days and nights. She had truly fancied herself in love with William. But was it love? Was what she experienced all that she was capable of? Perhaps with her own kind, with Hunting Wolf, it would be different. She had failed William and would likely fail the Indian. The thought of marriage was as burdensome as lugging a wagon behind her up a hill from the row houses to Mulberry Street. Yet his eyes had held her, made her feel alive. To his lodge, he had said. One separate lodge? Or a communal longhouse? The decision was too monumental, too formidable today with the sky the color of the Indian's turquoise, the clouds large and puffy like whipped cream, the air brisk and invigorating, alive with swaying branches and the smell of black walnuts hidden in wet brown grasses. Squirrels were romping and collecting hickory nuts which still clung to their summer branches, reluctant to fall and become the squirrel's winter staple. The women were headed north from town on the level road, passing homesteads that were turning into well-organized farms, each year making a difference in the amount of buildings and the cleared land. Hester was grateful, as they drove by the well-kept farm where she had spent her years with William, that Johnny kept up the tradition of tidiness. The fields were clean of corn fodder, the woodpile was stacked neatly, the cows looked well-kept in the barnyard. Well, you had to give him that credit. He had, by all accounts, forgotten about pestering them, the silly man. He simply had never grown up. Despite having a wife and children, he acted like a youth. How could he have grown up in the same house and have had the same parents as William? Her sober, conservative, meticulously versed William. A great tenderness rose in her. A memory of William's face and his touch.
You better get him going or we'll be late.
Bubby's voice broke in on her thoughts. How far is it to Jacob's?
At least another 3 miles.
Dutifully, Hester brought the whip from under the seat and flicked it lightly over Silver's back. The air whizzed past as he lunged forward. Hester shivered, tugging at her hat. The women that stood around the kitchen of the stone house shook hands with both Bubby and Hester. Their lips met in a brief kiss of holiness, the traditional greeting among the women. Jacob Stoltzfus's wife, Veronica, was flushed and nerved up, the way women were when church was at their house and they were responsible for the comfort of the congregation. Was the house too cold? Too warm? Was there enough food for the dinner table? How many Fremma would show up? Having made their rounds of greetings, Hester stood to the right of the fireplace, her arms crossed at her waist in a familiar stance, the way most of the women did. She looked around at the typical whitewashed walls, the shelves built on top of the sturdy cupboard that contained all Veronica's dishes. She admired the embroidered artwork on the wall and noticed the heavy pewter of the candle holders. The curtains which hung on the one window in the kitchen appeared to be very worldly, crocheted along the edges like Emma Fairies. But then Veronica was said to have a hankering for fanciness she'd heard from Buppy. In the center of the heavy oak table was a brown pitcher filled with sumac and goldenrod mixed with foxtails. My, it was so beautiful. Who would have thought that an assortment of plain weeds could be so pretty? Wistfully, she thought of her own blue dishes, more expensive and prettier than anything Veronica owned. The same with the hooked rugs Frances made, too. At the thought of her mother-in-law, She looked for her among the circle of women, remembering now that she had not greeted her. Was she sick? Leaning towards Samuel Suk's wife, she inquired about Francis's absence in quiet tones. Taken aback, Lydia opened her eyes wide, then leaned close to whisper in her ear.
Hadn't you heard? She requested to be put out of the church.
Hester could not believe it. They had missed church 2 weeks ago, so they hadn't found out, nor had Hester been to any quiltings or other social events. It would have been far too much like gossip to inquire about Francis's reason for doing this. At her age, a highly unusual happening. But then, she had always been a bit strange, like a... Hester tried hard not to think of which reasons her highly critical mother-in-law might have cited for leaving the church, because, well, it was the Sabbath and she should do her best to live right. She suppressed a giggle and kept her face hidden from Buppy, striving to keep her thoughts and intentions pure. She sat with the women, singing with a clear and rousing soprano, then listened carefully to the words of Bishop Joel Stoltzfus. He warned of worldly lusts and the hellfire that would surely rain on their heads were they to disobey. He spoke of the need to live wholesome lives, upright and honest in all business dealings, to work the land by the sweat of their brow, the women bearing children as was commanded by the Lord. Oh, how glad I would be to have children of my own, Hester thought, with a longing so intense she felt a physical ache in the pit of her stomach. Lowering her head, she pictured black-haired, naked little Indian children playing with bones and dogs, running among dusty intestines as the women butchered the wild animals. She shuddered. She knew she did not want to be alone for the remainder of her years here on Earth, but... Joel Stoltzfus's face reddened, and he lifted his fist along with his voice as it rose and fell in a sing-song chant, carried through the generations like a ribbon from the Catholic Mass, their ancestors. The sound made Hester feel a part of these people, these darkly clad, sincere, spiritually hungry and thirsty people who longed to do what was right. Everyone, in their own ways, did the very best they could, given the nature they each had. Often the children were raised with stringent rules and punishment, so they became their parents, passing the traditions and views onto their children, resulting in a tightly knit group of conservative people. On her knees, in silent prayer, Hester brought a heartfelt petition to God, asking that he show her the way in Jesus' name. The second and longer sermon was preached by a fiery old minister named Eli Fisher. His head was bald and shining, his beard in lustrous health, perhaps because he had no hair on his head. The gray beard seemed to come alive, jumping and swaying as he lifted his head, opened his mouth, and expounded on the word of God in all its power. That two-edged sword sliced right through the middle of the congregation and revealed their sinning souls. Brother Eli clapped a skinny, work-roughened hand to his bald head, then wept and pleaded. He slammed himself back against the wall when the immensity of the seriousness of life became almost more than he could bear. His hands shook, he swayed on his feet, he swung his thin arms and called each person to repentance. Babies cried and were carried discreetly from the room. A young child was pinched by a frustrated father, the ensuing wail bringing a clap to the face with a handkerchief. Somewhere, the sound of soft snoring... The men looked at one another with shamed smiles surfacing. Eyebrows lifted, a resounding punch was administered, and then a loud snort echoed through the room. Women craned their necks. Who was snoring? Shame on him. Aha, young Willie Suk, out too late last evening with Fanny. They sat at the dinner table then, eating bread and dried apple pie, cup cheese, pickled cucumbers, and spiced red beets. There was cold water to drink. Hester longed for a cup of hot tea, but that would be too much work on the Sabbath day. Buppy approached the ministers about helping to cut firewood for the Heinz Hoffmann family. She was told they would not get involved in those lazy Germans' lives, and if she knew what was good for them, she wouldn't either. Then Joel Stoltzfus told her in authoritative tones that Hester and she would better start considering moving back to the country.
Some of the Gleeda were not satisfied with the way they lived in town, hawking their vegetables, perhaps being less sober and reserved than the world expected of the pious Amish. They would be better off as keepers of the home, quiet, devout, and not walking the streets of Lancaster, often with their caps untied. Someone had seen them wearing coats without the required shawls and hats. If they did not conform, they would be subject to a visit from the deacon. It would be better for them to marry, bear children, and look after their husbands, he informed Buppy, not unkindly. He wished her Hail Zaya, and his eyes softened when he looked at Buppy's plain, freckled face. He walked away, aware of the minister's duties that were not always so pleasant. But he did agree with the lay member that Buppy's voice at market was anything but chaste and humble. Buppy was furious. She leaned forward and slapped both reins down on Silver's rump until the poor horse flew along the road, the buggy tipping and careening, bits of water, mud, and gravel spitting out from under his hooves until their faces were peppered, and Hester couldn't tell which were mud splatters and which were freckles all over Buppy's face. Buppy talked as fast as she drove. She said, couldn't he see how homely she was, ugly as a mud fence, and God had made her that way? Was it her fault that no man wanted her for his wife? How was she supposed to go about making a living, huh? How? She scraped the back of her hand repeatedly across her cheeks, then blew her running nose into the edge of her black shawl.
And not one of those men will help gather firewood for them!
She shouted into the wind, a strand of brilliant red hair loosening and waving above her black hat like a torch. Hester assured her that she was not ugly. She just had never met the right person. Buppy snorted so loudly that Silver broke into a gallop.
You can say that, you with all your beauty.
I'm not married.
Ha! Well, I'm going to get a load of firewood if I have to chop every piece myself. I don't understand. Evidently, you have to be Amish to receive any help. Puh!
Hester placed a comforting hand on Buppy's arm. You won't have to chop firewood alone. I'll help. Buppy sniffed and looked straight ahead. Chapter 22. Walter Trout helped. They drove Johnny's wagon out to Barbara King's homestead and cut firewood in the brisk gray day. The sun was a mist-shrouded orb overhead, coal insufficient and half-hidden in the dreary skies. Chopping and loading the wood kept them warm, their breaths coming in short white puffs as they worked. The great Belgians stood patiently, dozing in the still November air as the wood clunked into the sturdy oak wagon bed. Walter worked alongside, grunting, puffing, and perspiring. At precisely 10 o'clock, he announced his wish for the luncheon Emma had prepared.
Ah, yes, a bit early, perhaps, but to the working man, having a full stomach is of great and utmost import.
Buppy grinned cheekily and gave the axe a good whack into the chopping block. She dusted her hands by clapping them together and said loudly,
Where is this picnic?
Walter was already arranging a blanket on the leeward side of the wagon. Giving it a final pat, he happily dug through the large wicker basket. He brought out a loaf of bread first, cut into inch-thick slices. Chunks of fried ham were laid between the slices after a thick layer of yellow salted butter was applied with intense concentration. Every corner of the bread was covered precisely. There was cold buttermilk, spicy little cucumber pickles, hard-boiled eggs, spiced peaches, sugar cookies, and wedges of squash pie with cinnamon, brown sugar, and nutmeg sprinkled over the top. Walter was in his glory, his eyes shining with the purest delight as he ate. Such large quantities disappeared from the spread on the blanket that perhaps even Emma would have become concerned. He dabbed delicately at his mouth with the cloth napkin, belched quietly behind it, arranged the belt of his trousers more comfortably, and, humming delicately, cut a slice of pie that was very nearly half of the whole. "Fuel for the soul," he crooned after swallowing every bit.
"I thought preachers supplied that,"
Buppy said.
"Oh, they do. But if I had my choice, I'm afraid the squash pie would prevail indeed."
His shoulders shook with merry giggles. Word spread among the row houses. Something had happened at Heinz Hoffman's.
Finny was working, the children were clean, they ate green things, Tron survived the infection. Their house was warm. When a few houses down, a young girl was taken sick with pleurisy and bleeding in her lungs, Finny reported this to Hester, who had merely come for a visit, eager to hear how Finny was doing. Instantly, Hester thought of the red bethroot, bayberry root, and witch hazel leaves, which she boiled in wine and then stirred in a teaspoon of honey. This was the ancient treatment for pleurisy that she had learned from the book. Bleeding of the lungs? Or consumption? These were deadly viruses that spread like wildfire. She shivered with Finny beside her as they walked to Bessie's house. Bessie was the wife of Joe Reed, a Scots-Irishman who had fallen on hard times, having broken his hip in a farm accident. He was able to walk, but only by leaning heavily on a cane. His wife Bessie was at least 20 years younger and bore him a child each year, with little or no means to provide for them. The house was bigger than the Hoffmans, if only by a few feet. It was decidedly cleaner, but so bare of even the most basic necessities, it was hard for Hester to grasp the Spartan conditions the family lived in. Joe was a gentleman, proud, kind, and so polite. He bowed over Hester's hand and thanked her for coming in an Irish brogue so thick she could not understand his speech. Bessie was English, her words spoken precisely. Toothless, thin, and her brown and curly hair riotous, Bessie looked out of eyes that were flat and strained with the impossibility of her days. She was barefoot, her too short dress showing puffy ankles crisscrossed by bulging blue veins. A baby slept in a broken cradle close to the hearth. A group of thin toddlers were lined up on a bench, either sucking on a thumb or a finger, or holding a corn cob as if it were a doll. The girl with the sickness was propped up against the outer wall by a rolled-up blanket, her chest heaving as she struggled to breathe. Her eyes were sunken in her face, her lips apart, cracked and bleeding, a gray pallor spread across her features.
"This is Dulcie."
Hester bent to her line of vision. "Hello, Dulcie." A rolling of the eyes and a slow drooping of the tired lids were the only signs that she had heard. One thing was certain. Dulcie was very sick. To Hester, it looked as if she had an ongoing case of consumption, likely well-seated, which was in fact not curable. Why the smaller children had not come down with it, she didn't know. Perhaps it wasn't the dreaded illness. Elecampane, pignut, sage, horehound, yellow perilla, Solomon seal, golden seal, all boiled in rainwater. She had the tincture at home. Again, Buppy accompanied her, cleaning and giving the family food and clothing. When the women had no more extras to give, they went door to door asking for clothing, food, or whatever they had to spare. Buppy said there was no difference between that and peddling wares. Lots of the Amish peddled vegetables, bread, pies, and cakes. They approached gabled brick houses with ornate white trim, where the front doors were opulent, and there was a brass ring to lift and let fall without smashing your knuckles. Servants, mostly black-skinned housekeepers in immaculate white caps and aprons, opened the doors, shook their heads from side to side, and spoke in low, velvety voices. "No, ma'am. Sorry, ma'am. Not today, ma'am." When Dulcie breathed her last, Hester cried. Buppy rubbed her shoulders and blinked rapidly, saying she didn't think she would die. They buried her in the common graveyard where the town's poor laid their children. Hester stood in the biting December air, hung her head, and raged at the rich who lived inside their protected brick walls, surrounded by wealth and plenty, their consciences and their money secured by brick walls as well. She kicked pebbles the whole way home, her nose red from crying, her soul withered within. "I'm going to go with Hunting Wolf. I can't stand another day of this. We did all we could for the Hoffman family, and what happens? He's in jail? Dulcie dies? What's the use?" Buppy inserted the key into the lock. They let themselves in, shivering and rubbing their hands. Hester poked up the fire, laid small pieces of split wood on the burning embers, and watched it flame up before swinging the kettle over it. They stood in their black shawls and hats, staring morosely into the gray, joyless day, their spirits trampled as if a giant hoof had staggered all over them.
I guess there's not much to say, except that the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away, Hester said softly.
They have too many children anyway,
Buppy said gruffly, slamming her